Accession number 31699, reel 3.
No roughly sawn or anything. I thought, oh God, we've got to burn all this. I can make a shed out of this. I had it at home. But never mind. I used to do the porridge and the scrambled egg. Mind you, going back to the tea, rows of these tea urns, looking like these cool boxes, were on, I think there must have been two girders, side by side, long girders, with the fire in between, and the tea urns were placed side by side and boiled up. I think they started about 3 hours before breakfast or something, get them hot. And prior to that, prior to making the tea for the lads, you boiled your clothes up in them. you did your laundry in one of these things, and then when you'd done your laundry, you made the tea. Life was hard in those days.
Was anything else added to the tea?
No, yes. Oh, what's the stuff called?
Bromide?
Bromide, yeah.
You had experience of that being?
Yeah. For obvious reasons.
Did it have any effect?
No. But I think there was quite a bit of gonorrhea and, you know, that sort of thing about. So it was well keep clear, which I did. And, you know, you don't want to go home, end up in hospital with a packet, as they say. So.
Was that something that was fairly explicitly prohibited? And
no, it was not specifically prohibited, because in Algiers they had these special places, put it crudely, knocking shops, which were regulated. The girls had green cards, I think it was, to say they'd been examined and all the rest of it, but still dodgy. So you laid off some of them, you know, went around there, not regularly, but occasionally. But no, I laid off that for a simple reason, because in the camp there were notices up, you know, check yourself, and if you any signs of anything, see the MO. But in my mind, it wasn't worth the risk. Even though these people were regulated, but regulated by whom, I don't know. So there you are. Yeah.
But you did have experience of bromide being added to the tea?
Yes. Yes. I think it was everybody had that in the forces.
From where did the supplies come that you were using for the...
I don't know. I never found out. They must have come up by lorry from somewhere. Because we had an enormous store of packing cases and crates and things like that. Tin fruit. Would you believe it? I mean, I went round the store one day and I think I found two small crates of peaches. Well, they didn't go very far with 2000. Yeah, they never saw the outside except we sent a few over the fence and buried them in the tent. Just dug a hole and put the stuff down there, and we opened it up when nobody was looking. But generally speaking, and if you worked in the cookhouse, you had all these little perks. Looked around and said, oh, there's only one crate of that. Oh, well, let's open it up and have a good meal. Steak, and I used to do scalloped potatoes, and oh, yeah. It was a bit more luxurious than the outside people queuing up. Except we had to queue up for breakfast. Well, I suppose we had to queue up for everything, really. Although I worked in the cookhouse, I still for some reason, still had to queue up with the lads outside for my breakfast. But I can remember I used to do the, as I say, I used to do the porridge and the scrambled egg. Porridge, never a problem. Used to fill up the, because these tureens were about 2 foot across and about probably deeper than 2 feet, full of porridge. And you used to start this off early in the morning. And of course, to heat them again, wood, break up wood, fill up the, open the little drawer, fill it up. And we used to get cigarettes in tins. I think 100 or 50, 50 or 100 in a tin. And we had paraffin, which found. Shove the paraffin in. Of course, these things never cool down. You see, you just put the paraffin, fling it through the door. White steam would come out from the paraffin, and then you stand back, light a match, and you throw it in. There's a dirty great whoop, just like that. All the dirt come out the flue into the porridge, and you just sort of stirred it all in, you know. And that's how we did the porridge. Didn't happen every day, but there must have been quite a bit of black in the porridge at certain times. The scrambled egg was another, quite something different. These used to come in very large tins. Don't know where they came from, just powdered egg. You used to pour into the tureen, and we used to mix it up with water. Despite the instructions saying, and I think you had to use milk or something even with it, but you couldn't get milk. At least not for porridge, for a scrambled egg. I used to mix it up with water, and it looked good. It tasted very, very nice. And I remember coming up for my breakfast one morning, and Jeff in front of me said, "Oh God," he said, "scrambled egg again." He said, "If I can lay my hands on that bloke that does a scrambled egg," he said, "I'll kill him." I thought, you know, but not say anything. But it was, because of nothing like tomato ketchup or anything like that to put on anything, and meager meals. Basic meals, and that was it. Oh dear, oh dear. And then, of course, I had another brush with law, if you like. I used to come off night shift cookhouse about 7 o'clock, I think it was, 7 o'clock in the morning. I had my breakfast, go back to the tent. Go to bed. And it was the morning when we had CO's inspection. I was asleep. And all of a sudden, sergeant was in the tent, his entourage and the CO. And I heard, "What's his airman doing in bed?" "Well, he should be on parade," or words to that effect. And I said, "Bugger off, I'm night shift cookhouse." And one day I didn't get charged, but I didn't. They said he's been working all night, you know, and that was all right. And that passed off all right, luckily. And that was it. Then, of course, this sort of existence went on for, as I say, weeks, and it went on for, I think it went on for a month or more. So my chums had all disappeared. They'd been given postings, so I thought, well, I must do something about this. So I went down the orderly room and I asked them why I was still there. It was quite simple. I wasn't there. I wasn't on the list for anything. I've got to walk out the camp and nobody would know why or anything. I wasn't there. I wasn't on any list at all. So, having sorted that out, the officer said, "Where would you like to go?" I said, "There's a nice little depot down the road at Mason Carey." This was a motor transport depot where I think we were partly servicing vehicle lorries mainly, and building lorries from coming out of the packing cases. And the weather was dreadful, rain, mud everywhere. To keep out of the mud, if you were doing anything under a vehicle, you had the side of a packing case to work on top of the mud. Anyway, this chap at the Audley room said, "Where would you like to go?" And I said, "Mason Carey." "Right," he said, "there is one vacancy down there." He said, "I'll get your kit packed, be here by 12 o'clock. So I hastily packed all my stuff, presented myself in the Audley room, 12 o'clock, onto a lorry, and I went down to Mason Carey. Not far away, still just outside Algiers. Lovely road leading up, tree lined all the way up to the. I don't know how I can describe the place. They must have grown grapes for wine somewhere up, which I never saw. It must have been somewhere where we worked, but it just never registered. But they had wine vats there. Large, when I say large wine, concrete wine vats. And when I got there, I thought, well, this is not bad. First thing the sergeant said, welcome. There's plenty of wood in over there. There's packing cases all stacked up, broken wood and all the rest of it. He says, make yourself a bed. I thought, make yourself a bed? He said, yes. He said, and then you take it up the ladder onto the top of the wine vats. Well, I thought, right, that's fair enough. Plenty of wood. 4x2 and all this. So he gave me a saw and a hammer. And another chap was making his bed as well. And I think they were all second-hand nails straightened out, And I made myself quite a nice bed out of mainly 4x2 wood. But, and I thought, while other people were putting floorboarding or planks, as you might call, across the bed, where you the part that you lie on, I thought, right, well, I think I can do better than that. So I went around the corner somewhere, and I found a great heap of steel packing straps, which had just been dumped. So I singled all this out, and I don't know how I managed to cut the stuff, but at any rate, I put the straps across the bed, interwoven them, and I made quite a nice springy sort of mattress. And nobody else had ever thought of this, So I could have patented it, I think. But anyway, the chap next door to me, he was making his bed, and I thought, you'll never get that through the door. He made it too comfortable. And of course, no, he couldn't. Got the top of the step, top of the ladder, he wouldn't go through the doorway, so mum's all right. And then when you got inside, on top of the wine vats, they were very, very big wine vats, believe you me. And I don't know how many there were, but it accommodated all the camp on top of the vats. So it must have been a very big binary, I suppose you'd call it. And they said, sergeant said, well, sort yourself out on top of the wine vat, put in your bed where the roof doesn't leak. The roof, and just the tiles and nothing else. And he said, be careful to put your ground sheet on in case it leaks, and if your roof leaks, you move your bed over a bit, and so on. And I stayed there quite a long time. But you had to get used to living rough. On top of the wine vat, this was all concrete. There was a round hole with a concrete ball on the top of it to let the put all the wine. Well, I say wine; it was vino. We did sample it. It was like drinking vinegar. But all through the night and day, these were going off, and it could keep you awake. And well, there we are. We survived. We assembled vehicles there, and we had a big Leyland workshop there, a mobile workshop. I think we had two big cranes which worked throughout the day, all the engine running all day, lifting stuff, all that type of thing. I do recall there were showers there, all cold water showers. And that's not very good in the middle of winter. And it rained and it rained and it rained at times. And we used to hang up tarpaulin over the job we were doing, strung between trees. And we just worked under the trees the best we could.
How well did you find you acclimatised to?
Yeah, quite well. Yeah. When we weren't working, we used to go into Algiers. It was a very interesting place. There was cinemas there, there was an opera house. I went to the opera one night. I don't think I went to the cinema. I had my photograph taken in the street, street photographer. Took a picture and developed it on the spot while he waited, standing on the curb, you know. And we used to mooch around the town. We weren't allowed to go up to the Casbah. That was out of bounds because of safety. We did go up there occasionally, have a look around, see the place. Not right into the place, but get an idea what the Casbah looked like. Dreadful place. But and then the local people, I'm sure it wouldn't be allowed now. The French did not, they might just as well have not existed. It was dreadful. They literally walked around the streets in rags. You see Dickensian pictures of boys in rags. They were just like that. And they couldn't go into any places. They were just outcasts. That's one of the best. I don't know how they lived. They must have scrounged scraps from here, there and everywhere. And I remember I was with my mates, and we were walking along a main street, and this woman came along with in her rags, just lifted up the rags and weed on the pavement. Things were like that. I went up some steps, there was a crowd gathered, and when I looked over, a chap had fallen, split his head open. Nobody called an ambulance. You don't call the ambulance for the locals. And he must have died on the spot. It was terrible the way the French, I suppose you can call them, treated the local people. If you went down to the docks, there were feces everywhere. Up in all the corners of the docks. And but the town itself, it was a beautiful city. There were trams, buses, big blocks of flats. Excuse me. And we worked quite hard, and after a period of time I got transferred to Maison Blanche, another motor transport depot, and this was a very much bigger place. We had big workshops. We used to rebuild and overhaul lorry engines, car engines, big compressors, air compressors. And I remember we had a big American air compressor, mobile job, and a massive engine on it. I don't know how many main bearings on it, but it was burning about half a gallon of oil a day. It was so clapped out. So we took it out of service, took the engine out, and reboiled it by hand. The blacksmiths did all the metalling of the big ends and all the rest of it, the main bearings, and we had a hand thing with cutters on, and we cut the new bearings. Fitted it all back together again, it worked all right. Some interesting jobs. And I was assembling mainly at Maison Blanche. It was a big assembly place. Lorries used to come in from Canada and they were delivered to us by a lorry. I think there were about three at a time piled up. Big crates of them, and the chassis engine, just the bare block in the engine, in the chassis. You get your front axle and then you get your back axle, all in the same box. Great big box of nuts and bolts, all the fittings needed for the engine, the cab, wheels. But the actual bodywork came in a separate crate. But assembling these vehicles was quite a tricky task if you didn't know what you were doing. But all the instructions came in a book. How to do it. So these came from Canada, Chevrolet. And what they did was they put all the nuts and bolts in a whopping great box, and everything for a particular part of the assembly or lorry came in little cotton bags. There would be, you put on three small nuts, three small bolts for a certain job, and each of those little bags would contain a little piece of shredded, looked like shredded paper. The number on, and you can match that number with the book. Mind you, it would take about a year to assemble the lorry, but that would tell you where those nuts and bolts went. And a thick book in each of these packing cases telling you how to maintain the vehicle. A proper bound book, you know, like a paperback you get now, but if it's a book about that square. They all did it, Ford did it, Chevrolet did it, and you were in no debt. You didn't, if you'd never seen the lorry or anything like it, and you weren't mechanically minded, you could assemble a vehicle by just emptying out what was in the cotton bag, a little piece of paper out, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Looking up the book, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and it till you went, wait. There were dozens of these little bags. Oh, God. What we did, we just emptied the whole lot out into a box and sorted it out from there. And that's how we assembled the vehicles.
How robust were they once they were built?
Very, very robust. You can still see them. If you go to any of these open day places where they have these sort of army manoeuvres or preserve stuff, you know, you can still see these vehicles about. There's a while or two I came across them down in it was Ashford. They had a big display on. I thought to myself, oh, I might have assembled that, you know, several one like it. And then after that you had to assemble the body. Just an ordinary sort of a tipper body, you know, the type of thing, with the rails going over. And that was the easy part. And we did all this, and of course you line them up. It's a bit methodical. You line up all the chassis, and then you line up all the bodies. And you can imagine, perhaps after you'd done quite a number of these, you ended up with one chassis, no body. So you put that to one side. We're always sort of well ahead of the game. So you put that to one side. And you put the bodies on the vehicles, and then you find that you had something else left over, and eventually you could make up an illicit vehicle, and then perhaps not the body for that particular vehicle, but another body would fit it, and so sort of a bastardized vehicle, which we had, and so we thought, oh, well, this is good. We'll put the body on, and we'll take it back to the camp. And we used to use this to go up and down to Algiers. We ran it, mind you, we ran it on 100 octane aircraft fuel. I don't know where we got it from, but we did. We got it, and of course, it knackered the engine. But it got us down to town and back again, until some joker spotted that there was no number on the radiator, because all vehicles had numbers each side. You've probably seen it, or a round one as well. There was nothing on this at all, and it was reported. And of course, that was the end of that. We had to rely on ordinary transport. And then, you know, if it was a lorry going down to town, they'd take it. But most times, we got down to town. All right, had a good time in town. As I say, I went to the opera once or twice, and then of course getting home was another problem. But there were so many Americans down in their lorries. You just stand on a certain corner, and just thumb a lift, and they stop where you're going, and they tell them and in. Clamber aboard and they'd take you back to the camp. They were very good, Yanks.
What were the relations like then between the British and the Americans?
Oh, good. Very good. Yeah, very good indeed.
What about with the local population in Algiers?
All right, yes. You know, there was no problem at all from my point of view, anyway. And, we all seem to get on quite well. Yes, I was very grateful to the Yanks for their transport service. There was always a lorry. They were everywhere. And the Yanks were very good. I had to go into the American camp one day because I was working on a vehicle, and some parts of an American vehicle.